You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. April 24th is Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day. But there is a chapter of the genocide story you probably don't know, even if you studied this in history classes. It involves the Armenian Church, the J. Paul Getty Museum, and a lawsuit over part of a medieval manuscript. UC Davis art professor Dr. Hegnar Zeitlian-Wattenpah traces this remarkable story in her latest book. It is titled The Missing Pages, and the book was recently a new and noteworthy selection by the New York Times. Dr. Wattenpah, great to have you back on Insight.
I'm delighted to be here.
So where and when does this story begin?
Well, for me, the story began on June 1, 2010, when I read a news item that the Armenian Church had sued the J. Paul Getty Museum. And I was stunned because, of course, I'm a member of the Armenian Church. I've also been a Getty Fellow. So it was as if two parts of my identity had come into conflict, and I wanted to know more about what the dispute was about.
The rest of the story begins centuries ago.
In the middle of the 13th century, in a beautiful castle on the Euphrates River, where the person who is now recognized as the greatest Armenian medieval artist, Toros Roslin, created a beautiful gospels for his patron, the head of the Armenian church.
What we end up talking about is eight pages of a manuscript. So I think in context, we have to talk about what you call the mother manuscript and then these eight pages. As an art object, as an artifact in the world, what is this and what does it mean?
Originally, the object that was created was a gospel book with a beautiful binding. At some point in the during the events of the Armenian Genocide, eight beautifully illuminated pages were separated from the main manuscript. And the manuscript ended up decades later and in the Republic of Armenia, whereas those eight glittering pages ended up at the Getty Museum. These pages are canon tables, which are like an index of sorts to the Gospels. And they're beautifully illuminated with abstract ornament, but also these wonderful animals and fruits, and including those two roosters that are on the cover of my book that stride very confidently towards a vase.
Let's go back to Toros Roslin. He's a bit of a mystery himself. How is it that he came to create what have become some of the most powerful, holy, and rare images in the world?
That was one of the mysteries I had to confront. I realized that the person that we now recognize as one of the most important medieval artists, we knew nothing about him for seven centuries. His name completely disappeared from history. We know very little about him, but what we do know about him comes from his own words. He signed his name in the seven manuscripts that are known to be by him, and he says a few things about himself, the name of his brother, but he spends most of his time talking about his patrons and with pious invocations.
Let me go back to your first words about this. You were reading a newspaper, and you saw an article in June of 2010. What was happening as you read that article, and what did you decide to do next?
I was really intrigued with the way in which the two sides were characterizing the work in question.
The Armenian Church versus the J. Paul Getty Museum.
For the Armenian Church, this was a sacred object that had miraculous powers. For the J. Paul Getty Museum, this was a beautiful work of art that deserved to be in a great collection and to be shown to the largest public.
So let's go back to that manuscript. It had stayed for centuries in a tiny church somewhere, a remote church, right?
A remote church in a mountain village alongside many other medieval relics. But only this manuscript has survived from all of the treasures in the churches and monasteries of that area.
So the manuscript moved intact, and then came the era of World War I and what happened?
That was the period of time that was under contention in the lawsuit. And from what is possible to reconstruct is that the manuscript was taken out of the remote town of the church that it was in for all these centuries, and it moved from place to place. And at some point, the 8 pages, the canon tables, were separated from the rest of the manuscript and made their own way through Ellis Island and eventually to Los Angeles.
There had been a stop in Aleppo at one point, wasn't there?
It is not exactly clear how they got to Aleppo, but the Archbishop of Aleppo did a complete description of the pages.
And you know this not only by following documents, but you literally traveled the path that the manuscript and the 8 pages traveled.
Yes, that was one of the things I wanted to do to understand this manuscript, is to retrace its steps, to go to the various places where it had been, even when there was not much left of the places and buildings where the manuscript spent time. So I went to Hromgla, the castle on the Euphrates, where it was created, to Zeytun, the mountain town, where it last served as a religious object, to Marash, another town where it experienced some, the manuscript was lost, then found again. And also the Republic of Armenia, where the main manuscript, the mother manuscript, is preserved today.
Other than this court case in Los Angeles, a lot of this story was unknown, or even if pieces of it were known, it hadn't been constructed as an entire biography before, had it?
It had not. And that was the revelation for me, how the life of this manuscript over its 700 years was also a way in which one could tell the history of the Armenian people.
At what point did you say, I've got to be all in on this? I have to commit to wholly telling the story. I can't just write a short story about, you know, when it stopped in Aleppo, for example.
There was some sense at the beginning that I would focus on the court case, because it was a very interesting court case and brings up a lot of issues about the responsibilities of museums today. How should works of art be displayed that are also religious objects? But at some point, it became clear to me that the entirety of the life of this object was powerful, and that the court case was one episode of its long and fascinating life.
You are listening to Dr. Hegnar Zeitlian Wattenpah. She is professor of art history at UC Davis, professor of urban and architectural history in Islamic studies at UC Davis, and she is the author of the new book we're talking about, The Missing Pages, The Modern Life of a Medieval Manuscript from Genocide to Justice. She is going to present more of the story than you're hearing here at the Manetti Shrem Museum on the UC Davis campus, April 25th at 7 p.m. The day before, April 24th, I referenced as Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day. Is this observed nearly all over the world except Turkey?
It is observed all over the world, and in the last few years, it has also been observed in Turkey by members of human rights associations who come together in near Taksim Square in Istanbul and other places as well, in order to remember this crime and this tragedy that is not publicly and officially acknowledged in Turkey.
And speak to that, why it continues to remain controversial, and some people might not know the history of the genocide.
One of the burdens that Armenian genocide faces is that the events continue to be denied by the successor state to the Ottoman Empire that was the perpetrator state of the genocide. And it has become part of the foundation myth of the Turkish state that there was no founding crime, that these are all lies. And even though in the last few years there has been tremendous work by various Turkish citizens in order to think about the foundation of their state, the continued history of violence and impunity in that state, and to really do a thorough work of memory, officially, that denial is still official policy.
What do you consider to be the homeland of the Armenian people?
goodness.
I know that's a very big, much debated, much written about question. I'm just curious about someone who studies the history, the art history, the placing of objects, the tracing of objects. What in your mind represents homeland?
I've visited my ancestral homelands that are today in Turkey, my father's village near the Mediterranean in the Musa Dağ mountain. And I feel a deep sense of connectedness to that place, though I know that I am not going to return there. Many of my Armenian friends feel a very deep connection to the Republic of Armenia, as do I. But I think objects like the Zeytun Gospels are also, that are the part of which is now at the Getty. These objects are also places that create, they're objects that create spaces where we are at home, where we can connect with our culture, our religion, and the deep roots of faith and beauty that our ancestors created for us today.
That brings us back, I guess, to the court case. What happened? What was decided?
After 5 years of mediation and litigation, the church and the Getty settled. The Getty acknowledged that the eight pages had always been, had historically been the church's, and the church in turn donated the pages at the Getty. So the pages remain in Los Angeles. And the mother manuscripts remain in Armenia.
How much time have you spent pondering over them, looking at them in the Getty where they now reside?
I've been very fortunate to visit them several times. And I think those pages, even though they are so small, are some of for me, it is the most beautiful work of art in the world. Every time I see them, I find new visual events, new elements that I had not suspected. The parchment is has a beautiful color, and some of the colors, like the red dots, have an almost three-dimensional quality. I think they're endlessly fascinating, and they're also sacred objects.
Would you paint more of a picture? Describe the size in inches, for example, and how is it that over such a long period of time, the integrity of the colors on the pages has stayed strong?
The Zeytun Gospels, of which the eight pages are a part, like many particularly valued gospel books in medieval times, were not really meant to be leafed through. Those beautiful illuminations were not really meant to be seen by everyone. So the manuscript spent most of its time as a sacred relic in a special box in a niche in the church on the Citadel of Zeytun. It was taken out on special occasions in processions around the city in order to ensure the protection of the town and its people. So most people probably saw it as this dazzling object with a beautiful binding that the priest would raise above the congregation. And that explains why the manuscript has enjoyed such a good state of preservation, even though it is 700 years old. It was rarely used. And the canon tables that you can on occasion see at the Getty are a combination of very abstract and very lively. And you are basically seeing an architectural frame, an ornate architectural frame. And within that are rows of numbers, which are the index. It's a concordance list of similar passages that appear in various gospels. For medieval Christianity, this index was extremely important theologically because it showed you how the four gospels were connected. They told the same story, and they also connected the New Testament to the Old Testament prophecies.
They are tiny.
Each page is about 8.5 by 11, the pages that you have on your desk.
As opposed to what we might think of in more modern times as the big Bible, for example, or the big Torah, a very large
Absolutely.
Brand.
It's a tiny object that demands your attention, that demands that you look at them in a very specific way.
Because we are talking about the power of objects and architecture, would you talk with me about the Notre Dame Cathedral? And with the fire happening, there's a phrase you use in your book in talking about objects, when it becomes the survivor object, when it has a story to tell. For example, the manuscript moving through the genocide and through war. So how, in your mind, has the Notre Dame Cathedral shifted now in its existence and power in the world?
Well, when we all saw those photographs of Notre Dame burning, those of us who are not French, who are not Catholic, maybe who have not seen Notre Dame in person, except maybe in photos or in a certain Disney movie, Notre Dame, we all felt anguish and terror and maybe even visceral pain. And that really shows us how important cultural heritage is to us. To all of humanity, not only to the people of Paris or to the French, and Notre Dame, of course, in its very long life, it actually was created around the same time as the Zeitoun Gospels. It was completed in 1260. The Zeitoun Gospels was created in 1256. So in its long life, it has seen many depredations, the French Revolution, the assaults that it encountered during the First and Second World Wars, many other fires and other kinds of problems, and of course also decay over the course of time. So the fire that we saw recently was devastating, but this will not be the end of Notre Dame's life. It will be the beginning of a new phase of its life. And we're already seeing some very interesting discussions about how to rebuild the spire that was itself a construction of the 19th century. And I'm loving seeing all of these different ideas of how to bring the architecture of Notre Dame into the 21st century and how to connect the medieval past and the present in new and imaginative ways.
It's important to say in studying art history that you can look objectively at an object or a piece of architecture. And I'm thinking about your book from 2004, which was an award-winning book titled The Image of an Ottoman City, Architecture in Aleppo. And yet, like Notre Dame Cathedral, something can have dual narratives. Or more than that, it can be a narrative of reverence and love, enduring passion, and a narrative of oppression and pain and representative of a dark side of a life experience for people. And you can document that, but you try to look at something objectively in its history and path. Am I right?
And I was very interested in both documenting the sort of straight art history of this object or of Aleppo, the city that I worked on in the past. But at every turn, I discovered documents and saw testimonies about the deep connection that people formed with this object and with architecture. And I wanted to understand that more. It was as if the object itself exercised its own agency, its own power. Objects like the Zeitoun Gospels are considered to be miraculous. They are not inert objects. They are very potent objects that can accomplish miracles in the world. So I wanted to really understand how medieval people understood that and how people understand that today, how believers see sacred objects today. And what is that relationship between an object that is enhanced also by these incredible aesthetic qualities?
And do you believe in the miraculous qualities of objects?
Beth, I have to say, when I was in the presence of the Canon Tables at the Getty in a beautiful, you know, museum hall surrounded by many other visitors, I could feel the pull of this object. It's not just a work of art to me.
So has this work spawned new curiosities for you? Where do you go next in your research?
Many different directions. I'm pulled in many different directions. I'm very interested in these objects that, after atrocities or genocide, that have survived these atrocities, how they reinvent themselves in different contexts. And who are the people, especially the art dealers or other middlemen, who become purveyors of sacred objects for the art market. So there are some very interesting stories to be told about New York art dealers in the 30s and 40s who were involved in excavating but also buying objects from the Middle East, some of them like the Zeytun Gospel survivor objects and others newly discovered objects, and how they also created what we now understand as the field of Islamic art or the field of Byzantine art. So it's a very dynamic moment where art history is shifting and where Americans are discovering a wider world in a very interesting way.
Congratulations on the acclaim and the attention for this book, the place that it's holding for people, not only in a historical sense, but sort of in a detective style piece of literature, because you really had to go back and trace so much history and intrigue and be a little secretive at times about all this, right?
Yes, and I wanted to write the story of this book like a detective novel because I wanted to take the story to a wider public. So I didn't want to talk to only other art historians. And it was hard, but I'm just so happy that the book is able to connect with an audience.
The book is The Missing Pages. Dr. Hegnar, Zeitli, and Wattenpah will present the story at the Minetti Schrem Museum on the UC Davis campus on April 25th at 7 o'clock. We've posted more information. The pictures inside are beautiful. I think if you have never dipped into any of the history of the Armenian Genocide before, this is a fascinating place to begin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you here. This is Insight on CAP Radio.